I took my time that morning. The morning of the day I went to visit Anna. When was that? Must have been yesterday, I think. It was a day for fastidiousness in preparation. In the bathroom, I discovered that I'd run out of pills. Possibly I took more than I should have on Friday. It didn't matter. I wouldn't need them now. After breakfast, I packed my bag and got into the car. I reckoned I must be about 20 minutes from Anna's cottage, and I'd left myself an hour to reach it. It turned into a horrendous morning. Panicking, trying to read Anna's directions and to drive, both at the same time. As if that wasn't enough, at some point a sign told me that I was driving through the Blackdown Hills, that Anna now lived among the Blackdown Hills. Part of my brain told me that this symmetry was a good omen, the confirmation of a world in harmony. Another part told me it was an ill omen. On one Blackdown in Surrey, I had lost Anna. On another Blackdown in Somerset, I was looking for her, but had so far failed to find her. Perhaps I would always fail to find her. It was hopeless. I would have to call Anna's mobile. She had given me the number while pointing out that there was seldom a signal at her house. It was nearly midday by now. I made the call. There was no answer. I had no idea what message to leave on her voicemail, so I didn't leave one. Instead, I sat in the car, tears in my eyes. A reasonable man would retrace his tracks, get as close as he could to the destination, find a house, and knock on the door to ask for directions. I didn't know much about Anna's circumstances, but enough to describe her and the bare bones of her life, enough for her to be identified by a near neighbour. This reasonable man fell to pieces. Is that not reasonable? Why shouldn't a reasonable man fall to bloody pieces? Why does reasonable behaviour always have to relate to reason? Why can't emotional behaviour be reasonable? The sign that ushered me into Wellington declared that it had been voted the best medium-sized town in the southwest. When Anna had told me that she stood at a market stall on Saturday mornings, selling her produce, a bucolic image had come into my mind. The Wellington Farmers Market was nothing like I had imagined. It was indoors, for a start. A vast mural of spectacular ineptitude covered one long wall of a nonconformist church hall. The produce may have been local. Little of it seemed to have come from a farm. I first saw Anna across a crowded dance floor in a Methodist church hall in Haslemere in December 1966. I was staying for the weekend with Simon, an old friend, and was dancing with his sister, Linda. When I came up for air after a long snog, a girl was standing in the distance, in perfect focus. She was tall and slim, fine blonde hair falling to her shoulders. The main point was not the looks, fabulous though they were. The main point was the attitude. She was fully engaged with the two men she was standing with, laughing animatedly. At the same time, she seemed to be detached, sufficient in her own space, needing nothing and nobody. The next morning, I described her to Simon.
"Sounds like Anna," he said. "Anna Purdue.
If you can get close to Anna," said Simon, "you'll have done better than anyone else around here." Anna had said that she was usually on a stall at the farmer's market on Saturday mornings, but there wasn't one that day. Surely Wellington would be her local market. Perhaps she'd confused the dates. Anyway, she wasn't there. I found a pub nearby. I bought a pint of beer, sat down, and decided to feel sorry for myself. After a few minutes, I began to rip myself to pieces. "You stupid, useless bastard," I told myself. "Chucked out of your job because you can't hack it anymore. No guts to tell your wife you're out of work. More or less an alcoholic, give or take a baby sham. Shit husband and father, chasing some bit of skirt down in Somerset for God knows what reason. She didn't want you then, she doesn't want you now. And in any case, you can't even find her because you're such a useless prat." For some reason, I said all this out loud. It made it more official. An old man sitting at the next table smiled at me.
"Please don't take this amiss," he said. "But is everything all right?" "I think I will take it amiss," I said. "I'm up to here with bloody psychiatrists. I don't need another one." "That's strange," said the man who said his name was Ernest. "I am a psychiatrist. Psychologist, in fact." "Do you have any pills?" "No. Why, should I?" "I don't know," I said. "I'd have thought you would. Psychologist, psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, psychotherapist, psychobabble, psychobollocks. And no bloody pills. Trickling around the country with your bicycle clips, poking your nose into other people's business. Are you trying to tell me I'm ill?" "No, no, not at all. Implying I'm one stick short of a rhubarb patch. No, I wasn't suggesting any such thing. Well, it's been very nice meeting you. Mr. Marrow," I said. "Very nice meeting you, Mr. Marrow. I ought to be going now." He drained his glass and walked swiftly out of the pub. I wandered back to the car. I think I fell asleep. When I awoke, and for want of a more appealing alternative, I decided I'd better do what I should have done that morning. I drove back to what I thought was roughly the area in which Anna lived, stopped at a cottage, and knocked. A woman came to the door. I asked her if she knew where Anna Purdue lived. She did not. After more explanations and descriptions, it turned out that Anna was now Anna Halfyard and lived a couple of miles away. "Not an easy place to find," the woman said. Armed with fresh and precise directions, I set off once again. Eventually, I pulled up in front of a small Victorian cottage in the middle of fields. Pinned to the front door was a note addressed to me. I unpinned it. "Dear Matthew," it said, "I'm so sorry. I have to be somewhere else today. Genuine emergency. Promise. Couldn't ring because you didn't give me your number. We'll be back late tonight if you're still around tomorrow. If you feel like a cup of tea, the door's open. Really sorry. Love, Anna." I pinned the note back on the door, not yet sure what reply I would write, or whether I would write one at all. It is a Saturday afternoon in July 1967. I've gone down to the Surrey-Sussex border for the day to see my old friend Simon. He's playing cricket for the village team. I arrive at the pub about 12:30. It's already full. Simon and I drink and chat for an hour or more. Then I see Anna in the distance. "That's Anna Purdue, isn't it?" "Yes," says Simon. "Still fancy her? Come over, I'll introduce you." We walk across the grass. Simon throws his arms around Anna and kisses her. "To what do I owe this pleasure?" asks Anna. "Not to me," says Simon. "I'd run a mile from you." "To him. This is my old mate, Matthew. He's hopelessly in love with you. At least, I've told him it's hopeless." "Idiot," says Anna, to one or other of us. "I've got to go and get changed," says Simon. He wanders towards the pavilion. "Do you live near here?" I ask. "Over there," she waves in the direction of some trees. When Simon returns to us in his whites, he says, "We lost the toss and they're batting. I'll be in the field till tea time." "That'll be boring," says Anna. "Why don't we go somewhere? Have you got a car?" And so I am lying in the long grass with Anna Purdue in a field near the top of Blackdown. We talk of many things, serious, trivial, ludicrous, pretentious. Not much about our feelings, at least not towards each other. A transistor radio, secreted in the grass, fills the gaps in the conversation, apposite in its punctuation. "Waterloo sunset, a whiter shade of pale, take me in your arms and love me." "What are you doing after university?" she asks. "I only know the things I'm not going to do." "Which are?" "I'm never going to work in an office. I'm never going to wear a suit and tie." "You will," said Anna. "Everybody does." "I shall be different." "We'll all be different. And we shall all be the same." We're half sitting up now, resting on our elbows, looking at each other. I move my head slowly towards her, my lips slowly towards hers. Anna puts up a hand, ruffles my hair, stops my head from moving any further. "Not now," she says. We don't say anything for a while. "Do you like France?" she asks. "I love it." "I'm going next week," says Anna. "On your own?" "No, with a friend. A girlfriend," says Anna. She smiles. A money spider is inching down my arm. We both watch it crawl. "Anna, where do you think you'll be in 50 years' time?" She pauses to think, is then quite definite. "I will be living in a small rented cottage in Dorset, digging my vegetable patch, keeping chickens, and writing to the newspapers about the decline of the modern novel. What will you be doing?" "Coming to visit you," I say, "and suggesting it's about time we had an affair, before we're both too senile." I might say yes.
"You mean I've got to wait that long?"
"At least. Of course, you could always come to France next week."
"I can't," I say. "I'd love to, but I can't."
"Why not?"
"No money."
"That's a poor excuse. Don't be so unimaginative. Come to France. You'll regret it if you don't." I wonder if I will regret it, and decide I won't. It's not as if I'll never see Anna again. It's true that I don't have any money. It's also true that I don't want to be sharing Anna with anyone, even a girlfriend.
"When do you get back?"
"End of August."
"Shall I call you then?"
She gives me her number. I telephone Anna after she has returned from her holiday, and I speak to her mother. She goes to fetch Anna, returns to say that Anna must have gone out. I call again a few days later and leave my number for Anna to call me, if she feels like it, and hear nothing. In early October, she answers the telephone herself. She can't talk for long because she's off to Exeter University the next day. My suggestion that we might meet up in the Christmas holidays is met with indifference. The unmistakable message is that Anna Perdue has no interest in seeing me again. That autumn I write a poem that I like, and I send it to her. It isn't anything as obvious as a love poem. Hope I've learnt something. I hear nothing back.